today's speaker. Professor Schelling is Distinguished University Professor at the University of Maryland and Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at Harvard University. He holds an AB in Economics from Berkeley and a PhD from Harvard. His list of significant achievements since then is so long that for me to read it would take up a large proportion of the time we have available today. So let me just pick out a few, probably the ones that will make you most envious. Professor Schelling devoted the initial stage of his career to public service and sorting out the White House in the early 50s. He has been a member of several government advisory boards. He received the Frank Zeidman Distinguished Award in Political Economy in 1977 and became president of the American Economic Association in 1991. Not only has he written many words, he has written many very wise words. Professor Schelling was a pioneer in the application of game theoretic reasoning to problems of conflict and bargaining, and in an explicit modeling of the micro-macro link, developments which have been crucial to the progress of social science this century. He has described and analyzed systems of behavior in which unintended consequences result from participants ignoring the effects of their decisions on others. He has made us acutely aware of our failures to organize ourselves socially and of the inherent inertia in social decision making. He has contributed immensely to the literature on rationality, morality, and public policy. To summarize, very few men have had an impact of a similar magnitude on the social sciences. Let me now turn to the topic of today's lecture, global warming. The phenomenon of climate change is very complex. It involves problems of equity, both between generations and between different regions of the world. The Earth's climate is a public good, or a bad, maybe, in this country, and attempts to control it through reduction of CO2 emissions are therefore subject to intense conflict. Who could be in a better position to discuss these issues than the author of The Strategy of Conflict? Professor Schelling.
Thank you, Diane. I'm sure you're all waiting to hear whether it's going to get any warmer here in the UK. And I can't promise you that it will, but the subject of global warming is one that I would guess none of you had heard of 15 years ago. One or two of you may. 15 years ago, it was simply not a known subject, neither in the scientific community nor in the policy community nor anywhere else. Just to give you an example of how little known it was, in 1978, I was one of 20 people on a study group. This was back in the era of the energy crisis of the middle 1970s and the early 1980s. I was a member of a study group that included economists, nuclear engineers, biologists, energy businessmen, and so forth. And we were financed by the Ford Foundation to look into the question of nuclear energy. What was the future role of nuclear energy, mainly for electric power? We published a book called Nuclear Power Questions and Issues. The book appeared, I think, in 1979. It was 400 pages. It had 8 or 9 pages on the health consequences of burning coal, and it had 1.5 pages on the greenhouse issue. Now, there couldn't possibly have been a stronger argument in favor of nuclear power back in those days than the argument that nuclear power doesn't produce greenhouse gases. And we absolutely ignored, neglected the single most important consideration about nuclear power after nuclear safety that was ever going to come to the front. A year or two later, I was in another group, not the same people, about the same number of people, economists, energy engineers, businessmen, electric power people, and so forth. And we produced another book, this time called Energy, the Next 20 Years. I looked back at it recently. I checked all the references in the index. We published a 600-page book. And there were 10 scattered references to the greenhouse phenomenon, adding up to a total of just under 6 pages. 6 out of 600. Imagine the embarrassment of a title, The Next 20 Years. And before the 20 years were up, the single most dramatic issue about energy received 1/100th of the space of the book that we were writing. Well, it would be an interesting question in the sociology of science and the sociology of policy why this subject received so little attention 15, 16, 17, 18 years ago. The basic atmospheric physics and chemistry of the greenhouse phenomena, namely the ability of carbon dioxide and a few other gases to absorb radiation at some wavelengths in the infrared part of the spectrum, that had been known for 100 years. There's nothing new in that. It was known. Why didn't anybody pay any attention to it 15 years ago? And why now is it just about the biggest subject on the diplomatic agenda? 6 years ago, in Rio de Janeiro, there occurred the biggest international governmental gathering that had ever occurred anywhere in the world. I met a young Brazilian who was in charge of finding 25,000 hotel rooms for the people who were going to go there. President Bush went and about 100 heads of state. And the primary item on the agenda was the greenhouse phenomenon, which 10 years earlier, none of the people gathering in Rio had even heard of. I quite by accident got involved in the subject along about 1980, just after I had participated in these two embarrassing books. And when I got involved in the subject, I think there were two economists in the United States who had any interest in or any involvement with the greenhouse phenomenon and the possibility of global warming and climate change. There are now many, many more than 200 American economists, and in Western Europe there are hundreds more who are concerned with the subject. At least 200 American economists make a career dealing with greenhouse gases and global warming and climate change. So it's been, the number has increased a hundredfold in the last 10 or 15 years. I must tell you that there are a lot of things uncertain about this subject. One thing I should tell you, global warming is something of a misnomer. It isn't simply expected that with the further accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, things are going to get warmer. Average surface atmospheric warming globally is expected to be a main part of the engine that will cause climate change. The second main part will be a differential. The warming that is expected to occur is likely to occur much more in the polar regions than in the equatorial regions. And because a main driving force in the circulation of the air and correspondingly in the oceans is the temperature gradient or differential between the polar regions and the equatorial regions, a change in that gradient will have a lot to do with a change in the air convection of air due to the temperature differential. And if you combine that change in the gradient with the circulation of the Earth, you get a substantial change in the circulation of the atmosphere. And it is expected that this will change climates. Not a change in climate, but a change in climates all over the globe, perhaps. Some places may get warmer, some may get cooler, some may get wetter, some may get drier, some may get sunnier, some may get cloudier, some may get more storms, some may get fewer storms. It isn't expected just that things will get warmer. So when you see, as we did on the front of Newsweek magazine about 7 or 8 years ago, the Earth portrayed as a great big red, sweating face to portray global warming. Or the New Republic, just a couple of months ago, again, had a great big red face depicting the globe, the Earth. That's simply taking the shorthand formulation and taking it seriously, and it shouldn't be taken that seriously. The average global warming will be a main part of the engine that drives the changes, but the changes are not expected to be noticed, if they are noticed, merely as warming. But the beginning question scientifically is, how much change might there be in the average global surface atmospheric temperature if we do get more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? And the question is usually posed for, say, a doubling of the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. How much temperature change might occur, since all the other changes are expected to be a function of the change in the average temperature? This is a basic, or maybe the basic, scientific question. In 1977, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences put together a committee to look at that question, and the committee reported that the change in average global surface atmospheric temperature that might accompany a doubling of the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would be anywhere from 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius. Now, that's a very wide range. That's as if somebody told you that if you don't stop eating dessert, you're going to put on somewhere between 15 and 45 extra pounds. And the range is large. It's remarkable that the last time the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the huge international consortium of scientists who provide most of the basic data for meetings like the one we had in Kyoto last December and for the one in Rio in 1992, that body continually re-examines this study of the National Academy of Sciences, and at last report found no reason to change that estimate. Now, considering how much money has gone into climate research in the last dozen years, 100 times more money has been spent on the subject in the last dozen years than ever before in all of history. You'd think that we would have a better estimate than the one that a committee came up with in 1977. But the estimate hasn't changed. I think there may be two reasons. One, there may be some cultural inertia. Nobody wants to stick his neck out with a new estimate because he would have to defend it, and people aren't sure enough how to make these estimates that anybody wants to propose supplanting the old estimate with a new one. I think a second thing that happened is that climate may be like a few other subjects. I have a hunch that brain science and genetics both turned out upon examination to be vastly more complicated than they were believed to be 20 or 30 years ago. And I think climate turns out to be much more complicated than was appreciated even 15 years ago. 15 years ago, clouds were not taken seriously. Now clouds are recognized as playing a very complex role. Some clouds, depending on the way they're formed, primarily reflect incoming sunlight, and some of them primarily absorb outgoing heat radiation, and therefore the role that clouds play is complicated. Oceans were thought of 15 years ago as merely a huge cooling reservoir that would slow down the warming of the atmosphere but not significantly affect it. Now the oceans are recognized as playing a very complex role in the transport of heat from the equator to the northern latitudes. And indeed, if there is any possible now conjectured, if not now foreseen, potential disaster that might occur from climate change, it would paradoxically be that maybe the British Isles will get colder, because one possibility is that a very special phenomenon known as deep water formation, which occurs between Iceland and Greenland, is a place where what began as the Gulf Stream cools off, becomes heavier than the surrounding water, sinks to the bottom of the ocean, and migrates over the course of 1,000 years around into the Pacific. And if anything caused that deep water formation to cease, the Gulf Stream might have no place to go and might meander around farther south, leaving Scandinavia and Britain without the benefit of the warm water that keeps your climate so benign. That's a possibility, and I mention it because it's about the only currently conjectured discontinuity or potentially not catastrophic, but especially serious consequence of climate change. Now, I said it's uncertain how much the average temperature will go up with, say, a doubling of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And a doubling, it's simply, you talk about a doubling because if you're going to make estimates, you may as well pick a benchmark, and doubling makes sense because doubling will undoubtedly occur sometime in the coming century. And doubling generally is thought to be enough to make a noticeable change in climates, but probably not enough to cause any kind of catastrophe. And right now, just if you're interested in numbers, there are about 700 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere. And we are adding about 3 or 3.5 billion tons per year. So if carbon dioxide emissions were stabilized at their current levels in perpetuity, in about 100 years, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would have doubled. Ordinarily, if nobody did anything about it, carbon emissions would go on increasing as they have been increasing, especially as the developing countries use more and more fossil fuels. So almost certainly, if nothing were done about it, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would double long before the next century were over. What are likely to be the changes in climates? Well, this isn't very well known. There are a lot of meteorological laboratories that produce estimates of what the changes in climates will be, and about the only thing they agree on is that maybe the U.S. Corn Belt will move a little bit north, and maybe the same will occur in the Ukraine. But by and large, the meteorological models that are used are simply very coarse models. Among other things, they can't make any allowance for mountains. Well, you might say, who cares? Switzerland is a mountain. Not many people live in the high mountains. But if you realize that India, Burma, Pakistan, Bangladesh all depend on snow in the Himalayas for irrigation, as does California depend on snow in the Sierras and the Rocky Mountains, mountains are very important. And I mentioned that just as an example, that the climate models, I would say the climate modelers that I know don't have much confidence in their predictions of climates. What about the impact of climate change? Or what kinds of climate change? The general expectation among the people who do this professionally is that climates will change gradually. They will change gradually over time, that is slowly, and in a way they will change gradually geographically, so that the if you know the states in the United States, the climate of Kansas may become more like the climate of Oklahoma, which is just south of Kansas. And the climate of Nebraska may become more like the climate of Kansas, which is just south of Nebraska. And the climate of South Dakota may become more like the climate of Nebraska, which is just beneath it. But the climate of Kansas isn't going to become like the climate of Oregon or Louisiana or Massachusetts or Florida or anything of the sort. So in a way, you might say climates will tend to migrate. That's the general expectation. Not confidently expected. It's partly because the people who do this work don't know what to put into their models that might lead to abrupt changes or discontinuous changes. So in a way, the models they work with may produce only gradual change because that's all they are capable of producing. What might the impact be? Well, here I think it's important to recognize we're talking about climate change that may occur over the next 50 or 75 years. Not much, anything noticeable is expected to occur in the first 25 years or so. And therefore, you have to try to imagine climate change occurring on the world as it is going to be, along about the time your grandchildren or great-grandchildren are going to school. And it's not easy to think about the kind of world that is going to be. I use the example, if 75 years ago, climate change had been predicted. That is, not particular climate changes, but the possibility of climate change. And I asked myself, what in America would people have thought likely to be the main environmental consequence of climate change? I think the answer would have been mud. 75 years ago in the United States, the worst environmental problem, aside from snow, was mud. Automobile tires were about 3 inches in diameter. Cars got stuck in mud. Horses had to pull them out. Bicycles couldn't operate in mud. People walked long distances in those days, and walking in mud was arduous. And somebody might have said, if with climate change things get wetter and wetter, they will get muddier and muddier, and that will be dreadful. On the other hand, if things get drier and drier, we won't have nearly as much mud to worry about, especially in the summertime. But in 1921 or 22, people might not have realized that the United States would be paved absolutely solid by 1998. And none of my children has ever driven a car in mud, and none of my grandchildren has ever seen a car driving in mud. So I mention that to suggest we've got to think of this as superimposed on the world of the future. I'll give you a dramatic example. People who try to think of what could be the worst possible result of global warming and climate change nowadays seem to think that the worst result may be an increasing incidence of and severity of tropical diseases. Because when the tropics get warmer, if they do, the virulence of many of these microorganisms may become worse, and the vectors that carry them, the fleas, the lice, the snails, the mosquitoes, may become more vigorous, and the range within which these diseases occur may be extended both north and south from the equatorial regions. And people talk about the incidence of malaria, dengue fever, river blindness, and all of those things. I believe if you imagine 75 years of progress in sanitation, cleaner water, better public health infrastructure, better environmental protection against mosquitoes and things, and most important of all, healthier people, it is unlikely that these diseases are going to become more scourges than they are now. I was in Singapore 18 months ago. 30 years ago, Singapore was a swampy little dump full of mosquitoes, bad sanitation, unclean drinking water. Singapore now doesn't have malaria. The only people who get malaria in Singapore are the people who go for a holiday in Malaysia. There's a 1 kilometer causeway between Singapore and Malaysia is full of malaria. Singapore, they simply don't tolerate breeding places for mosquitoes, but mainly, if you get malaria in Singapore, you're already healthy, and you have access to good medical care. If necessary, you go to the hospital. But in Malaysia, people do not have access to that kind of best medical care. And Malaysia is particularly debilitating to people who are undernourished. And if you can imagine that in 50 years, Malaysia will get at least to where Singapore has already come in 30 years, then one can suppose that in many of these tropical countries, they will be as rid of mosquitoes as Singapore is now, and they will have better fed people. In fact, I don't suppose you've ever read of a case of death due to measles in the British Isles. Kids in England used to die of measles back in the Depression. The only kids that die of measles are kids who don't get enough to eat. 1 million children around the world die now from measles. But they die primarily because they're undernourished or they are already afflicted with other chronic diseases, so that a case of measles can kill them. If in 50 or 75 years, when climate may have changed, and may have changed for the worse, people are better fed and have better access to health care, it is unlikely that we will have a scandal like measles killing 1 million children. And it's unlikely the malaria will be as severe as people worry it may become. I don't know how many of you saw either the movie or read the book, Smiller's Sense of Snow. There is a grotesque parasite in there that kills half a dozen people up in the Arctic Circle, and they have trouble figuring out what this dreadful disease is. Well, it turns out it's something called the guinea worm, and I won't describe it for you because it is so disgusting that when I saw it on television, I wanted to shield my eyes. But the guinea worm is now pretty confidently expected to follow smallpox into total extinction within the next 10 or 20 years. And I think generally this illustrates that things are likely to get better with respect to tropical diseases, not worse. I'll give you one final example. There's something called dengue fever, which is transmitted by mosquitoes. And mosquitoes tend to be tropical, not completely so, but tend to be so. A very good example of the phenomenon I'm describing about the difference between healthcare, sanitation, and that sort of thing. There are two towns on the Rio Grande River. The Rio Grande separates Texas from Mexico. Two towns just across the river from each other. On the Mexican side, the incidence of dengue fever recently was 2,000 cases per 100,000 population. On the American side, the incidence was 7 cases per 100,000 population, a factor of 300 difference. Identical climates. The only difference is that on the American side, there is better environmental protection against the breeding of mosquitoes, better nutrition, better health care. And yet, even there, the American town is one of the poorest towns in the United States. And I think if you want to make a comparison between Singapore and Malaysia and translate it to the North American continent, the difference between the north side and the south side of the Rio Grande River may be a pretty good example. Now, who should worry about climate change? In connection with the Kyoto gathering last December, 165 nations gathered to talk about this subject, the developing countries' spokespersons accused the developed countries of being afraid of climate change and wanting to hold back the development of countries like China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, Nigeria, to hold them back, because otherwise, if they proceeded to develop, they would be emitting more and more carbon dioxide just on account of their use of energy, and that this would worsen the climate for the comfortable, fairly well-to-do people in the developed countries. And they argued that if anything is to be done about reducing carbon emissions in the developing countries, the developed countries would have to pay for it. I think on the latter point, they're absolutely right. I don't think the developing countries for the next 30 or 40 years are going to do anything about carbon emissions unless the rich countries pay for it. I think those spokespersons are wrong in believing that it's the developed countries that have the primary interest in forestalling climate change. Developed countries just aren't very vulnerable to climate. In terms of material welfare, in the components that go to make up the gross national product, there is almost nothing that depends on climate. There's hardly anything you do in the United Kingdom in what you produce, leaving aside agriculture. Agriculture and maybe fisheries.
Can you speak up, please?
Yes, is this okay now? There's hardly anything that goes on in the United Kingdom, a component of the GNP, other than agriculture, that can't be done in Florida, California, Massachusetts, Argentina, Chile, almost anywhere in the world. Manufacturing is rarely affected by climate. Communications now are rarely affected by climate. Little airplanes don't have to fly blind to deliver the airmail anymore. Construction doesn't depend much on climate. Where it does, it benefits from warmth. Transportation doesn't depend much on climate. Where it does, it'll probably benefit from a little more warmth. Medical care doesn't depend on climate. You can do open heart surgery in any country of the world. We could hold assemblies like this anywhere in the world. There just isn't much that is vulnerable to climate except agriculture. And even a lot of agriculture has gone indoors in developed countries in the last 30 or 40 years. But agriculture, you know, you may not think so if you take a train ride through the countryside in the British Isles or through the Corn Belt of my country, go through Iowa, Illinois, and so forth. But agriculture, for most developed countries, is less than 5% of the GNP. In the United States, it's less than 3% of the GNP. So few people earn their living mainly in farming now in the United States that our Census Bureau no longer counts farmers. And even a country like Israel, which traditionally was thought of as a country of kibbutzim living off the land, in Israel, agriculture is no more than 3% of the gross national product. In countries like Norway, Sweden, France, Netherlands, agriculture is terribly potent politically, but it, you know, it's a very small part of the GNP, and if food costs doubled, I don't think they could, but if food costs doubled as a result of climate change over the next 50 or 75 years, it would subtract 1 or 2% from per capita gross income, which by then will probably have doubled already in most of these countries. And in all likelihood, the improvements in agriculture that have been going on for 100 years will continue, perhaps with the benefit of genetic engineering. So it's very hard to make the case that any of us or our children or our grandchildren will notice the impact of climate change on what you might call the economics of material welfare. What about health and comfort? Well, I can't be sure. But I do feel pretty sure that if warming had been anticipated 100 years ago, people would be much more concerned with the benefits of warming in the winter, with earlier spring thaw, later fall frost, less ice and snow to bother with in the wintertime, whereas now we are so well-to-do that we think about how much warmer it may get in the worst months of the summer. My advice to the developing countries would be, you have vastly worse problems to worry about than climate change. You need clean water, you need sanitation, you need better public health. You need cleaner air to breathe. You need to do something about congestion and especially urban concentration. And in good course, you can begin to worry about climate change. But the best defense you have against climate change is your own development. Become less dependent on agriculture and other outdoor activities. So I neither expect that developing countries will make sacrifices in their own development to do anything about climate change, nor would I advise them to. Eventually, the Chinese are going to be emitting more carbon dioxide than the United States, probably within 25 years. Now they emit about half as much as the US, and at the rate they've been developing economically, 6, 8, or 10% per year, they'll probably pass the United States in another 20 or 25 years, and the developing, what we now call the developing world, will probably be producing more than half the global carbon emissions by sometime around 2030 or 2040. By then, it may be time to begin with a little bit of financial help to get them to do something about carbon emissions, and it may be that then we can talk to them about how they can now afford to do something to hold down carbon emissions. But I think for the time being, there's no chance that they will do anything but token participation in any kind of greenhouse abatement regime. The U.S. Senate, as some of you may know, passed a unanimous resolution last August or September that the United States should agree to nothing internationally in which the developing countries were not full-scale participants. And the United States did sign the Kyoto Protocol, and there was no sign that the developing countries would be full-scale participants. the White House let it be known that probably this treaty wouldn't even be submitted to the Senate for ratification for a few years in order to give a chance for diplomacy to bear fruit and bring the developing world into the regime. I don't believe anybody expects fruit to be born. And as a result, I think that what we have is right now a kind of pretense that maybe the developing world will come in. But now the title of my lecture was, Are We Prepared? Do We Know How to Organize Ourselves to Cope with This Issue? And I would say, in many respects, we don't know yet how to organize. First, who should do it? I think one of the big mistakes in the international greenhouse diplomacy is the basic principle that this has to be a universalist regime. I think if the OECD countries, or the better off countries within the OECD, can get their act together within 5 or 10 years and begin to think about how we might really, over the coming decades, decarbonize our energy, then will be time to go and look at the great countries like India, Indonesia, China, Nigeria, Brazil, and so forth, and talk to them about their participation. I think if we can spend 10 or 20 years demonstrating that eventually we have learned how to get our own emissions under control, then we can go talk to the poor countries about what they might try to do to participate. But for the time being, I think the most important issue is to decide who should participate in an international regime, and I think the answer at Kyoto, namely everybody, is the wrong answer. How to do it? And here a main question is, should it be voluntary and cooperative, or should there be something mandatory and enforceable? I don't see any sign that the United States is going to participate in some kind of enforceable regime where penalties will be exacted from the United States if it emits more than it is supposed to emit. It may be that in the next 10 or 20 years, some of the nations of the world will decide to impose sanctions, trade sanctions on countries that don't participate. Trade sanctions have not been one of the more successful and effective ways of bringing pressure to bear on other countries. And I have a hunch that people who think that maybe trade sanctions will bring compliance with enforceable emissions quotas are simply groping for straws, trying to figure out how in the world we might ever manage to make Spain or Portugal or Canada or Australia or the United States get its emissions under control if it doesn't take care of itself. I think for the time being, it's got to be a purely voluntary cooperative regime. Next question is whether we should be trying to impose uniform policies or standards, or let every country go its own way. My former colleague Richard Cooper in Foreign Affairs a month or so ago proposed that the best thing to do is to have a uniform tax on carbon. I think he'd be willing to have it currently just on the developed countries and not the developing countries. Economists tend to like the uniform tax on carbon. It has huge efficiency advantages. It means that where it's hard to do without carbon fuels, you pay your tax and go ahead, and where it's easy to do without carbon fuels, you avoid the tax and reduce your emissions. But I'm inclined to think that every nation is going to have to decide its own way of going about this. Maybe the European Union will begin eventually to think about some standard regulations in their building codes or in their automobile emission standards or something of the sort. But I think that by and large, if you're going to get cooperation from a country like the United States, it's going to be letting the United States decide how, if it is going to reduce emission, it is going to get those emissions down. There's a lot of interest in a trading system. Economists love trading systems. They're just like the uniform tax. The trading system is a sort of an alternative to the uniform tax, because if you have a quota imposed and you go above quota and you have to buy excess quota from another country, this is like a marginal tax on your emissions or a marginal subsidy on reduced emissions in the countries that can sell their excess quotas. I tend to think that this was an idea that appealed to President Bush for two reasons. One, it was market-oriented, and second, he knew it would never go into effect. And I think the Clinton administration may have gotten carried away and thinks there is something to it. 2,000 American economists recently signed a statement proposing that an international trading system coupled with mandatory fixed quotas was the only way to go. I didn't sign the statement, and I thought that, among other things, any quotas that were adopted now would have to be renegotiated within 10 years, because nobody has yet any good idea of how much emissions ought to be coming down over the next decade or two. And nobody in the United States, and my guess is nobody in any country, has a good idea of what it's going to take to get emissions down by 5, 10, 15, 20% below what they would otherwise be 10 or 15 years from now. And in that case, any quotas that were parceled out would be subject to renegotiation. And if you know that 5 or 10 years down the line the quotas are going to be readjusted, you will know that if you have unused quotas and you sell them for cash on an international market, that is merely an open declaration that you were dealt with too kindly in the initial distribution of quotas. Finally, the U.S. Undersecretary of State, who takes credit for most of the negotiation in Kyoto, says, at last we got what are known as firm targets and timetables. Targets and timetables has been part of the jargon of this kind of diplomacy recently. Targets and timetables means deciding by which year you will reduce your carbon emissions by how much. I tend to think that we will know that nations are serious about getting emissions down when they stop talking about targets and timetables and talk about the actions they propose to take. When the United States agreed in a sort of a tentative, soft-hearted way that we would get our emissions down 7% below 1990 levels sometime between 1908 and 1912, you could be confident that the United States government didn't know what it was talking about. There is nobody in the United States government who knows what will be required in order to get emissions down below the 1990 levels within the next 12 or 14 years. We had a little experience during the energy crisis of the 1970s and the early 1980s with what the long-term elasticity of demand for gasoline may be. But the energy crisis didn't last long enough to find out really what it was. I'll just give you an example. I think a good idea might be for the United States federal government to impose a gasoline tax beginning at 10 cents and going up by a dime per year for 15 years, so that after 15 years we had a dollar and a half federal tax on gasoline on top of the state taxes. That would not be a very high tax by European standards, but it would be a nice beginning in the United States. But I don't think there's anybody in the United States who can estimate now what such a tax would do to emissions 10, 15, or 20 years from now. What it would do to the kinds of automobiles that people bought, what it would do to the way they drive their cars, how much they drive their cars, how many people would shift to public transportation, whether people who now drive gas-guzzling, heavy pickup trucks and sports utility vehicles would go back to something like the early VW in order to save gasoline. Nobody knows. We don't have any experience. And therefore, I think to talk about firm timetables to reduce emissions is really to be blowing smoke. So that I would say when the U.S. government or any other government talks about the actions it's going to take, the regulations it will impose, the subsidies or the taxes that it plans to impose, the research and development it will undertake in order to develop less carbon-intensive forms of carbon, then I think you can say they're getting serious. But as long as they're just talking about whether they should reduce emissions 3, 5, 7, 10, or 12% below the old 1990 levels by some year like 1910 or 1915, I don't think you should take them seriously. You know, Margaret Thatcher about 11 years ago said that the UK would get its emissions back below the 1985 levels by the year 2005. But you knew then that Margaret Thatcher had no expectation that in 2005 she would have to face the House of Commons and explain why emissions hadn't followed the trajectory she proposed. Let me just say, I don't have much time left, but the kind of regime by which we might all collaborate in reducing greenhouse emissions is really pretty unprecedented. In the first place, as Diane said, this is a problem of the global common. All carbon emissions everywhere in the world get intermixed. It's all one global climate system. And probably no country, with the possible exception of the biggest country or two like the United States, would consider it much in its own interest to make much of a sacrifice to reduce carbon emissions, because the benefits will be shared around the world and the costs of what we do we pay, so that it essentially has to be a collaborative venture on a scale that has never before been attempted. You may think that the Montreal regime to get rid of CFCs was a good precedent, but I think getting carbon dioxide emissions down significantly will be larger by at least two and maybe three orders of magnitude than the cost of what was done with the chlorofluorocarbons. And furthermore, there were good substitutes over the horizon for the CFCs, and it isn't quite so good looking with respect to carbon. Second, there aren't any standards of fairness. Back right after World War II, there were a number of efforts to think about how burdens should be shared among countries. We had to decide how to share the contributions, the original endowments, to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. We had to decide how to share in contributions to the United Nations Reconstruction and Rehabilitation Administration. And I thought that we were beginning to develop some notions of what you might call the basic international income tax. Way back in the late 19th century, we had the International Postal Union, and there were some formulae according to which you paid, according to how big your population was and how big your area was. But by World War II, the notion had been, we think about GNP and GNP per capita, we think more in terms of something like an income tax. And I actually, in 1955, wrote a published essay on the developing international regimes and institutions of burden sharing, thinking that this was a developing field. The Cold War put an end to all that. We've never really developed notions of how to share burdens or how to share assets. And indeed, if you can imagine, in connection with an international trading system in carbon quotas, imagine getting 165 nations to sit down and divide up assets that are probably worth several trillion dollars, discounted value in perpetuity. We don't have any way of knowing how to do. We don't have any experience. We don't have any precedents. Furthermore, there's immense diversity in the use of fossil fuels among different countries. Some of these are due simply to tradition. Some have to do with what fuels were available historically. Some have to do with climate and heating and cooling. Some have to do with population density and how much transportation uses. But if we were to try to decide on emissions per capita for the people in the British Isles and the North American continent and Western Europe and so forth, we would be arguing for a long, long time. Furthermore, any regime to be taken seriously has to be virtually permanent. This is not simply getting through the next 5 years, or the next 10 years, or the next 20 years. Probably it's getting through the next 50, 75, or 100 years. If at the end of a century we've eliminated fossil fuels altogether, we can stop worrying about it. But any regime has got to last a long, long time. How big is the burden? The burden is probably on the order of a few percent, maybe 3 or 4% of GNP in perpetuity. 3 or 4% of GNP is not much if you just ask, suppose over the course of the next 10 or 20 years, GNP per capita was depressed 3 or 4% below what it is otherwise going to be, and then stayed forever 3 or 4 percentage points below where it would otherwise be. If you draw the per capita GNP on a sheet of paper this size, the difference between doing without 3 or 4% of GNP and not doing without it is about the thickness of a line drawn with a number two pencil. But 3 or 4% is politically immense. In my country, a 1% of GNP budget deficit was an unmanageable crisis. We got rid of the deficit, not because we managed the crisis, but the deficit disappeared. And I think in France, 2% of GNP is an unmanageable amount. If I could wave a wand and reduce productivity by 2 or 3 or 4% slowly, nobody would notice it. But if I impose gasoline taxes, somebody will notice. And therefore, I would say that the economic problem of reducing carbon emissions is large but not enormous. The political problem is perhaps not merely large, it may be enormous. The only precedent I can think of for this, and this has been a good year to think of it, last year was the 50th anniversary of the Harvard University commencement speech that launched the Marshall Plan. And about 7 weeks ago, the Marshall Plan began. 7 weeks ago, 50 years ago, the Marshall Plan began, April 5th. And you know, the Marshall Plan involved dividing up, say in the first year of the Marshall Plan, dividing up about $4 billion per year of aid to Western Europe, including the United Kingdom. That was only about 1.5, 1.75% of the US GNP. It's a lot more of the US GNP than any country has ever since given in foreign aid. So it was a significant thing for the US to do. Among the Europeans, it's hard to calculate the GNP percentage because it depends on what exchange rate you use. The UK share in the Marshall Plan in 1948-49, I forget the figure, it was probably on the order of £300 million. And if you calculated if then the next year after devaluation, you calculated the pound equivalent of the dollars received in 1948-49, it was more like £450 million. And if you asked what would it have been at an equilibrium exchange rate, it might have easily been on the order of 3, 4, 5, or 6% of British GNP. And the figure varied among the European countries, huge in Greece, small in the Netherlands, and very small in Belgium. But on the whole, I would say that dividing up the Marshall Plan is the only instance in history I can think of in which something was divided up that might be as important as the cost of reducing carbon emissions. And in the second year of the Marshall Plan, the United States said, we're not going to do it for you, you must divide it yourselves. And the recipient countries spent most of a year documenting what they proposed to do during the coming year and documenting their claim for a share of the $4 billion that was expected to be available. And they went through a procedure that I call multilateral reciprocal scrutiny. Delegates from all the countries met in Paris at the OEEC and spent months cross-examining each other, challenging each other's claims. Examining what you're doing about gasoline rationing, what you're doing about butter rationing, what you're doing about meat rationing, how much steel and other raw materials you're wasting by building football stadiums instead of factories, how rapidly you're rebuilding your herds of cattle, pigs, sheep, fowl with grain from the United States. And in the end, the recipient countries didn't quite agree on a division of the aid, but they were so close that two respected people could go away for the weekend and come back with a proposed division, which was then unanimously accepted. In other words, it was possible for the recipient countries dividing up something worth a few percent of GNP almost to reach a final agreement. Then, in the third year, what had been the Marshall Plan shifted to a NATO support program. And again, there was a question, how should the aid be divided in support of NATO, and how should the NATO burdens be divided? Now, these were real burdens. These had to do with conscripting soldiers into the army, keeping them in the army. It had to do with spending defense money on military supplies and equipment. And again, there was a procedure which I call multilateral reciprocal scrutiny, in the course of which the delegates from the countries, again meeting in Paris, the same delegates, you know, when the Marshall Plan changed to from European recovery to defense support, it was the same ball game with the same teams and the same players in the same ballpark, just a different name. They came very close in the at the end of the first year of NATO in agreeing on a division of burdens and a division of aid. This time that it took three arbitrators to go off for the weekend and come back with a proposal that was accepted. And I am inclined to think that if and when something like that Marshall Plan model can be acknowledged maybe to be the only incidence in history when anything as important as carbon emissions may prove to be got divided up in a civilized bargaining process, maybe something like that will be a model for how first the developed countries, the well-to-do countries, can get together and by a process of reciprocal scrutiny, cross-examination, using people at very high levels of government, people who don't like to be caught lying, exaggerating, people who don't like to go home shamefaced because they're not doing enough for the common good. It may be that eventually the OECD countries will develop some kind of a mechanism, perhaps looking a little like what was done in the Marshall Plan, and begin to get going on a regime in which countries will accept actions that they commit themselves to take in hopes that carbon emissions will come sufficiently down. I just have one final word for you. Probably, if we knew what the ultimate limit might be, the limit on carbon concentration in the atmosphere, the limit above which we might fear disaster but below which we were safe, it might be somewhere around, say, a doubling or a trebling of the recent past levels of carbon dioxide. If we had that, and if we then decided the crucial thing is not to surpass that limit, we would say the important thing is the limit on the ultimate concentration, not the annual emissions, then probably it wouldn't make climatically much difference how we approached that limit. We could try to approach it in the most economical way. And almost certainly, for several reasons that I don't have time to go into now, almost certainly the most economical way to get there would be to have emissions continue to rise significantly for the first 2, 3, or 4 decades, then level off, and then decline very severely after another 40 or 50 years. Some of the reasons are simple. One is we'll have much better technology in the future than we have now to get rid of carbon. Another is that it's a lot cheaper if you let existing obsolete plant wear out rather than supplant it with new, less carbonized systems. Old automobiles may disappear in 15 years. Old electric power plants may wear out in 30 or 40 years. Letting them wear out is a lot cheaper than replacing them now. Discounting, the sooner you spend money reducing carbon emissions, the more interest you will pay in the long run. And finally, I feel pretty sure, some of you may doubt this, I feel pretty sure that per capita incomes are going to continue to rise almost all over the world. And our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren will be better able to afford some of the costs of reducing carbon emissions. So my feeling is, I often sound very pessimistic when I talk about how little has been accomplished at Kyoto and such places in the last 5 or 6 years. But really my feeling is that this is an unprecedented challenge. It's going to take time to figure out what to do about it and how to go about doing it. It's going to require some experimentation. I think it's going to require some countries to take the lead in getting started and doing it cooperatively. And I think it's fortunate that we have some time to learn how to think about the subject and talk about the subject and eventually do something about it. Thank you.
Let me
go back to the first thing you said. I think you're right. Two things. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the sort of the officially designated body to provide scientific advice to governments dealing with this problem. My impression is that they are committed to the notion that this is a very serious problem, and they are in a kind of a perverse way. They're looking for the good news that climate change is real and is serious. The scientists there. They remind me just a little bit of the anti-nuclear people who used to think it was good news to have a nuclear accident because it proved how bad nuclear reactors were. I think you're right. In the United States, business interests have been very good at rounding up scientists who dispute not just the estimates that are being made about global warming, but even the basic idea. And indeed, I get almost every day in my office flyers from various organizations, the Coalition for This and the Institute for That, that refer to the greenhouse fraud, that this is a fallacy, a hoax. I also have the impression that serious American scientists, especially the meteorologists, don't have any such doubts. They simply aren't out parading their view. I think they prefer to work quietly. They do have influence on the government, and I think they'd rather not engage in a debating match. Now, as to whether we have time, you know, one can always say we've wasted 50 years already. We should have been doing this 50 years ago. We knew that carbon emissions were going to grow all over the world. Why didn't we do something about it? Or why didn't we do it 10 years ago or 5 years ago? And if I'm relaxed, it's only that I think I wouldn't want my government to be relaxed. When I said it may be okay for emissions to keep rising fairly substantially for another 20 or 30 years, because then it'll get much easier to reduce emissions substantially later. That'll only happen if we take very seriously the need for new technologies and the need for investment, probably public investment, or public commitment to ultimate regulations that will lead to private investment, that will lead to the same thing. President Clinton has not quite set aside, but said that he will be spending $5 billion over the next 5 years on research and development and subsidies for less carbon intensive heating systems and so forth. $5 billion over 5 years is nothing. You know, here we have an economy that is $6,000 billion, and he's going to put $1 billion per year into forestalling all of that. I think that simply illustrates that the White House hasn't got around to taking this seriously yet or thinking about it. I agree with you that in the Marshall Plan, the United States was always there, able to say, look, you can't have it if you don't agree on how to divide it. That we were in a very strong position, virtually to coerce the countries into coming to some reasonable division of aid, and we didn't have to participate in it ourselves. We were simply there saying, the money is here as soon as you can decide on how to divide it up. I simply don't know any other incident, precedent, illustration in history for this kind of thing. One might go back and look and see whether there were decisions made in World War II with respect to lend-lease and things of that sort that were the same way. But again, there the United States was in the granting position, and by the time lend-lease became important, there were only two recipients, Britain and the Soviet Union. So that I turned to the Marshall Plan partly because last year, it being the 50th anniversary, and I was involved in the Marshall Plan, so I was invited everywhere to talk about the Marshall Plan 50 years later, and it occurred to me that if one wanted to find what was there about the Marshall Plan that has significance for anything today, I thought, well, you know, they actually did divide up $4 billion, and that's a little like dividing up $1 trillion worth of emissions quotas. But if the only reason I'm optimistic is that I think that if it takes 10 or 15 years to learn how to do it right, and then we can begin to do it right, we'll make it through the century.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Dr. Schelling. I'm rather concerned that the impression you've given to everybody is one of pessimism more than optimism. I wonder if you'd mind if I give you something which I regard as being something which would help redress that balance in your perception and possibly some of the people here who may have derived the impression that I got from what you said. What I want to give you is a document which has been produced by an organization of parliamentarians called GLOBE. Your vice president is one of the founder members of this. It's Global Legislators Organization for Balanced Environment. It's parliamentarians from over 100 countries worldwide. They're all signed up and very strongly advocating a scheme which meets many of the criteria which you have drawn attention to this evening in respect of solving the problems of the global good, where everybody's interests have to be taken into account. It's a solution called contraction and convergence, and your government know this plan very well. in effect, privately, they've conceded the point. The important thing is so for Chinese media. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I, as an alumnus of this institution, I don't want to use intemperate language, but I found that the talk was indeed highly pessimistic, and I found it was quite casual with regard to a lot of the possible adverse effects of climate change. I didn't catch mention of desertification. I didn't catch mention of rising sea levels in places like Bangladesh, the Nile Delta, other deltas throughout the world. I think a lot of people also have a kind of regard for the climate. It's not simply a question of saying, well, it gets a bit warmer, the weather, or colder, or something, so maybe I can't spend so much time out in the garden. A lot of people find that there is a kind of strong bond that they have with their natural environment. And, you know, I'm sorry to say this, but I mean, the reference to suggesting people in the third world maybe have a little less dependence on agriculture, I find it's almost, dare I say, a kind of arrogance. I mean, so I think the problems are a great deal greater than you gave the impression of. In terms of solutions, you said, why don't we look at the Marshall Plan and can't think of anything else? Well, what happened just before the Marshall Plan was that there was a world war because a number of countries throughout the world were prepared to do something much greater than the kind of sacrifice involved in the Marshall Plan to defeat something that they saw as a serious problem for humanity. Now, if we have a serious problem for humanity, I mean, there'd be much more recent examples of the war against Iraq and so on, but the United States being prepared to militarily intervene with all the sacrifices that involved and all the potential adverse effects that involved. I would have thought that we shouldn't be pessimistic about the possibility of a civilized humanity that is more globally interconnected economically than it's ever been, that is more technologically advanced than it's ever been, for actually dealing with these kind of problems. And I would humbly suggest that the problems that people have are problems in addressing selfish, greedy, excessively consumerist lifestyles, and in facing up to the huge power interests of the motor industry, of the fossil fuel industries, that are standing in the way of us achieving the kind of changes which I think we ought to quite optimistically and hopefully look forward to achieving.
I don't think the climate change models predict desertification.
Well, in some cases, in Central Africa, you could certainly going to get desertification.
No, you're not certainly going to get it. You have been getting it. The question is whether the climate change expected to result from greenhouse gas accumulation is going to aggravate or ameliorate the desertification. And most of the models suggest the latter rather than the former. I wouldn't take them too seriously, but I think it is not the case that whenever somebody can predict a potentially foreseeable climate change, that it has to be a bad one. Now, you mentioned sea level. Sea level was, the likelihood of a rise in sea level was really spectacularly frightening 20 years ago. There's a body of ice, it's called grounded ice, the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, which is equivalent to an iceberg that got so big that it's resting on the bottom and has accumulated a few kilometers of ice on top of that. If an iceberg melts, if the whole Arctic ice flow melts, it does nothing to sea level by the principle of Archimedes. Ice displaces its own weight in water. But this West Antarctic ice sheet could have accounted for a really catastrophic 20-foot rise in sea level. This is something that can be surveyed, it can be estimated. It was to have been a 20-foot rise in sea level. And in the late 1970s, some of the predictions were that that could happen in 100 years, and that it would have become irreversible within the first 50 years. Now, 20 feet is really huge. I guess London would be flooded. Bangladesh would lose tens of thousands of square miles. It fortunately happened, a lot of money went into glaciology at the time, and satellite observation became possible, and they put beacons in a lot of the Antarctic glaciers, and they can now get very accurate measurements of the ice flows. And by about 1983, the estimate was that if that happened, it would take 500 years, not 100 years, that it would be slow and gradual, and probably wouldn't happen. Some likelihood that there will be increased snowfall in Antarctica, which would reduce sea level. The estimates now are that sea level will rise as a result of thermal expansion of the surface ocean and some possible melting of further melting of glaciers. And the expectation is on the order of 40 centimeters in 100 years. Those aren't my estimates, though the estimates that the scientific community that I deal with works with. 40 centimeters is serious for some parts of the world, but it's not catastrophic. Otherwise, on your notion that things are bad, we are a consumerist society, greedy for consumer goods, spending money in carbon-intensive ways. I can agree with you. I just don't see how it gets us anywhere to complain about that. I keep trying to look for ways that governments might agree on things to do. I think there's a prerequisite, which is that the government in the United States is going to have to come to the conclusion that this is a problem worth taking seriously. And I don't believe the government in the United States has reached any such conclusion. So I think there is nothing for it but to keep trying and hope that someday we will have a president who is willing to talk about things as ineffable as raising the price of gasoline by 25 cents a gallon. You know, Jimmy Carter tried it. He talked about 50 cents a gallon, and he was laughed back then during the energy crisis. Then John Anderson, who ran against both Carter and Reagan for president, talked about a 50 cent per gallon gasoline federal tax. He was laughed down. George Bush tried to get a 9 cent per gallon gasoline tax, and he settled for, I think, 4.5 cents. And Bill Clinton talked a little bit about maybe a carbon tax, but in the end, he agreed that a nickel a gallon was about all that made any sense. And a nickel a gallon on gasoline, a nickel a gallon on gasoline is no more than the difference between the price of gasoline on the east and the west sides of Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. So that I think that, I don't know whether, when you call me a pessimist, you mean I'm really an optimist. I'm very pessimist about anything very serious being done in the next several years. I'm an optimist that eventually these well-organized business interests that have been denouncing the greenhouse phenomenon as an environmentalist hoax will gradually be quieted down. There's some sign. Mobil Oil has come around and is now taking it seriously. And I think maybe the automobile companies can be brought around. The one industry group that is really taking it seriously is the insurance industry, especially the reinsurance industry. Because the insurance industry, believing the worst, thinks that we're going to have more hurricanes and more floods and things of that sort. And the insurance industry is going to have to find ways to, especially the reinsurance industry, to cope with disasters that strike locally the way hurricanes do. And I think both in this country and in the United States, there are now organized insurance interests trying to lend respectability to the notion that we ought to take the greenhouse problem seriously.
Okay, just one last question.
I have a really short question. Could you possibly elaborate a bit more on the likelihood of a worst case scenario? Not what the IPCC calls the worst case scenario from a scientific perspective, but that combined with a complete redundancy of the international regime, let's say, that countries such as India, China, Brazil, Malaysia, Indonesia, Mexico increase their carbon dioxide and all the greenhouse gas emissions by several orders of magnitude, and the U.S. is unable to curb its own emissions, same happens with Europe. cities in which the international regime is completely unable, which is something I increasingly think that is likely to be so, at least for several, for the coming, for the next future. That was one question. The other one is, for the people from the reinsurance sector, but also the people from the renewable energy sector, often claim that what makes hydrocarbon energy cheap has been for several decades market failures, fiscal incentives, and implicit subsidies, and so on, which provide for a certain amount of provide a possibility of dealing with those things by just fixing market values and eliminating subsidies and so on, in order to make it economically efficient to reduce
Let me take up your second point first. There are some people who think that the scarcity of carbon fuels will save us from the worst greenhouse catastrophe. Unfortunately, the fuels that are likely to get scarce are oil and gas, leaving a lot of coal and eventually a lot of tar sands and oil shale and so forth. Coal is much more carbon intensive than methane. So that in a way, if you look forward to an oil shortage saving us from the greenhouse problem, it may simply lead us back into the greater use of coal. There is an interesting possibility. I don't know much about it, but you know, there are huge deposits of methane underwater in offshore areas all around the world. And this could be both good and bad. If somebody learns to tap those deposits, they're called clathrates. They're a sort of a jelly-like formation that is neither crystalline nor ice, but it's some such thing. If we can learn to tap that, we've got more gas than we could ever use. The problem is, if it's tapped carelessly and methane leaks into the air, methane itself, molecule per molecule, is about 35 times as bad as carbon dioxide as an absorber of infrared radiation. And so methane is already recognized as one of the potentially serious greenhouse gases. But if, say, the countries of Central America decided to tap into these clathrate deposits, and they decided to help leaking gas into the atmosphere, let somebody else worry about that. We need the gas now. We could end up, if those gas deposits are exploited, if they're exploited badly, they could aggravate the problem and be worse than coal in that respect. Scenario, you know, the IPCC gives us what you call, what you might call a worst case political scenario. Nobody cooperates. They've never given us a worst case climate scenario. They've never described what may happen if greenhouse gases accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. Implicitly, they have suggested that probably the upper limit that we would want to see would be 750 parts per million, which is about 2.5 times the current concentration. But the only way I can say that's implicit is that they say, we don't know yet whether the ultimate appropriate limit should be 450, 550, 650, or 750 parts per million. And when they stop at 750, you get the impression they think that's as high as it should go. I don't think they take seriously the 450 parts per million anymore, because there's no chance that we would hold the concentrations to 450 parts per million. But they've never said what happened when it gets to be too much. And I think there are two kinds of things that might happen. One is that climates in various ways would simply become more onerous. They would deteriorate, get worse and worse. The other would be something cataclysmic, catastrophic. And the only one that gets much attention now is the possibility that the Gulf Stream would lose its momentum and meander around down below Spain rather than coming up to warm northern Western Europe. So that in a way, they have foreseen the possibility that as the so-called developing world becomes developed, they will be emitting eventually several times more than all of today's emissions combined. But one would hope, you know, I'm optimistic that somewhat in a way that wasn't adequately foreseen 15 years ago, much of the developing world is developing very rapidly. And what is now being referred to as the demographic transition, the tendency for lower birth rates to go with improving per capita incomes. This may mean that within 30, 40, or 50 years, the Chinese and the Indians and the Indonesians will be able to afford to take seriously the possibility that they've got at least as much at stake as we do in holding down emissions and will come around to some kind of participation. Other than that, I think the only thing we can count on is that if the OECD countries can get their own emissions under control in the next 10 or 15 years, then we can begin to talk about investing in what you might call a, quote, Marshall Plan to decarbonize the electric power supply in places like China, India, and so forth.
So, but isn't the 1995 report conclusive in that if the theory proves to be right, we are committed already to live with climate change for a couple of hundreds of years, if not for longer?
Oh, well, there's no way that we will stop emitting carbon in the next 50 years. You know, nobody's going to park all the cars, turn out all the lights. We're going to be emitting carbon, at least at the current rate, I think, for many, many decades. So that at least some significant, if there's anything to the theory at all, some significant climate change is bound to occur. But whether it needs to be catastrophic, whether it will lead to desertification, how much sea level rise, is hard to know. I do think it's worth recognizing that agriculture has been for a long, long time a very promising part of every country's economy in terms of productivity. And there, if you were to worry about global food supplies, probably the most serious thing to worry about is what's going to happen to the diets of the billions of people in the developing country when they can begin to afford meat, because meat is the great source that draws on grain production around the world. And if it turns out that with genetic engineering we can produce the same amount of pork with only two-thirds as many calories in grain, and produce milk with only two-thirds as many calories in grain and so forth, it may be that agriculture will go on being just a very fruitful source of improvement.
Okay, I think we have to end here. Thanks again for a very thought-provoking lecture.